"Bail with the bait pots," said Jack. "That is Lovell's Island there ahead. I believe we shall weather it."
"Aye, very well. There is a glutinous substance in these pots. I see the head of a decapod."
"Toss it out," said Jack, "and bail."
"Those, I presume," said Stephen, nodding towards the small craft ahead as he bailed, "are fishing boats that set out before us. But what is that?"
Over the shining sea, from the south end of the long island, came a cutter, pulling double-banked, pulling hard and fast into the eye of the wind. Its course would intercept the scows very soon indeed, the way those men were stretching out.
"Could you go a little faster, do you think?" asked Stephen.
Jack shook his head, stepped forward, and slowly lowered down the sail. The cutter was racing towards them. The men were armed, shoulder belts, cutlasses, tomahawks, and pistols, and in the stern sheets an officer bent urgently towards them, bawling,
"Stretch out! Stretch out!"
The coxswain at his side half rose and roared, "Make a lane there!" The small craft scattered. The cutter dashed through them, turned left-handed in a long curve that took it past the northern point of the big island, and so vanished, still at a racing speed.
"That was Lawrence, exercising his boarders," observed Jack as he hoisted the sail again. "He is a taut skipper, all right."
He found his heart beating double time, and he said,
"They will be back aboard the Chesapeake in 20 minutes at this rate, in spite of the tide. How is Diana?"
"There is a certain degree of prostration, benign prostration."
They looked at her, green, hair draggling over her clammy face, eyes closed, mouth clenched tight, a look of mingled death and stubborn resistance. Stephen wiped her cheek. Jack said,
"I shall favour the boat. You might move the bait pots and that old sack under her head. Perhaps she don't like the smell."
He took the scow wide of Lovell's Island, south about, to ease the motion. South about, with the battery under his lee, through the channel, and there, as he cleared the southern tip, he saw what his soul had longed to see. T'gansels and topsails, beyond the northernmost of the Brewster Islands, a ship standing in from the Graves. Without his telescope he could not swear she was the Shannon yet, and he said nothing. But in his heart he had a beautiful, calm certainty.
"You seem pleased, brother," said Stephen, after a while, looking from the green-yellow to the red and beaming face.
"Yes, I am, to be candid with you," said Jack. "And so will you be, I believe. You see that ship, just clear of the Northern Island now?"
"I do not."
"The Northern Island. The further island. The one on the left. Hull up, for God's sake."
"Ah, I perceive it now. And for what my opinion is worth, I should say it looks quite like a man of war. And there is a neatness, a certain air that we associate with a man of war."
Abandoning all opportunity for wit, Jack laughed aloud and said,
"That is Shannon, standing in for her morning look at the Chesapeake. Ha, ha, ha!"
The Shannon stood on, stemming the tide. The scow, as close-hauled as it would lie, steered to cross her bows. 2 miles had separated them at first. With their combined rates of sailing, this distance lessened to 0.5 mile in 10 minutes, and Jack saw that he could not fetch her on this tack. The scow's leeway was too great, and that going about would leave him in her wake.
"Did I speak too soon?"
he thought, and standing up he hailed as he had rarely hailed before.
"The ship ahoy! Shannon, ahoy!"
A moment of the most intense anxiety, and he saw the frigate back her for topsail. The way came off her just enough to let the scow run alongside. The awkward boat gave her a shrewd thump amidships, and from the deck above a thundering voice, a familiar voice, cried,
"Mind the paintwork! God damn your eyes! Mind the paintwork! Fend off! Have a mind to put a round shot through your bottom!"
Then, in a milder tone, "Well, Jonathan, have you any lobsters aboard? Paul, pass him a line." With the line firm in his hand and ease flooding through his heart, Jack could be facetious now.
"I must ask you to moderate your language, sir. We have a lady in the boat. Pray tell Captain Broke that I should like a word with him. Take your hands out of your pockets when you speak to me, Mr. Faulkner."
Blank consternation on the broad, honest, weather-beaten face above. The dawn of wrath. Shocked silence, fore and aft. Then a huge grin, and Faulkner cried,
"By dear me, 'tis Captain Aubrey! I beg your pardon, sir. I will jump to the cabin directly. Will you come aboard, sir?"
Running feet on deck, orders, urgent cries, the rumble of marines' boots, side boys running down with baize-covered ropes, and Jack, poised on the roll, stepped across the gap and came up the side, piped aboard in style. The marines presented arms. Jack took off his hat, and there was Broke, napkin in hand, egg dribbling down his chin.
"Why, Jack!" he cried. "How glad I am to see you! How come you here? How do you do? Your arm?"
"Philip," said Jack, "how do you do? I came in this boat, I do assure you. Might I beg for a bosun's chair? We have a lady aboard, somewhat indisposed. Sophie's cousin, Diana Villiers. And perhaps my surgeon might use it too. He is a prodigious doctor, but no great seaman."
Diana was hoisted up, limp, past caring, a dripping dead rat, a dripping dead female rat, and carried into the absent master's cabin. Stephen came up after her, and bending low to his ear as he struggled out of the bosun's chair, Jack murmured,
"I can say it now. We have escaped. Give you joy of your freedom, brother."
He then presented him.
"Dr. Maturin, my particular friend, Captain Broke. I say, Philip, you don't happen to be breakfasting, do you? Poor Maturin here is fairly clemmed, quite wasting away and fractious for want of food."
It was extraordinary how naval routine took them in once more. They had not been aboard a few hours before they were entirely at home. They might have been in the Shannon these last weeks, or even months, with all the familiar smells and sounds around them, and the familiar motion, unusually pronounced today. Not only had they several former shipmates before the mast, in the gunroom and in the cabin, but almost every detail of the Shannon's closely ordered life was the same as it had been in their other ships. And when the drum beat roast beef of old England for the officers' dinner, Stephen found that he salivated, in spite of his late and copious breakfast. Boston might have been 1,000 miles away, but for the fact that it could still be seen, down there at the bottom of its great bay, as the frigate stood out to sea again, her morning inspection done, to resume her long blockade. She was nothing much to look at, just an ordinary 38-gun 18-pounder frigate of about 1,000 tons, that had been shabbily treated by the dockyard in the article of paint, and that had been on the North American station for close on 2 years, in all weathers, most of them unpleasant, with ice forming thick on the yards, rigging and deck, playing old Harry with what very little she possessed in the way of ornament, or gingerbread work, or graces. But she was a happy ship. Her people had been together, with few changes for a man of war, ever since Broke commissioned her. They were thoroughly used to one another, to their officers, and to their work. And they worked well, a willing, efficient crew of seamen. Yet this happiness, at least as far as the gunroom was concerned, was overlaid by a heavy consciousness of defeat, a feeling that with the capture of 3 Royal Navy frigates in succession, the service had fallen far, far below itself, and a most eager, restless desire to avenge Gruyere, Macedonian, and Java. Stephen became aware of this when Watt, the first lieutenant, led him into the gunroom. Several officers were already there, and they made him very welcome. But once the introductions and the ordinary civilities were over, he might have been in the Java again. The atmosphere was much the same. Indeed, the officers were even more concerned about the American war. It was even more immediate to them, far more immediate, and they had been on the verge of action ever since it had been declared. From service gossip and the proceedings of the court-martial that acquitted Chads and the surviving officers of the Java, they knew far more about the battle with the Constitution than did Stephen. But there were gaps in their knowledge, and they plied him with questions. Had the Americans used bar shot? What effect did it have? Were there, in fact, many British deserters in the Constitution? At what range did she open fire? What did Dr. Maturin think of their standard of gunnery? Did her round shot break to pieces on impact? Was it true that the Americans used sheet lead for their cartridges?
"Gentlemen," said he, "I was below throughout the battle. I regret my ignorance, but—"
"But surely," said Mr. Jack, the Shannon surgeon, "surely you must have heard when the Vangs parted. Surely some casualty must have spoken to you of the Vangs."
"The captain's compliments to Dr. Maturin," said a tall master's mate, hurrying in, "and he begs the pleasure of his company at dinner."
"Mr. Cosnahan," said Stephen, shaking his hand, "I am delighted to see you again. Evidently healthy, apparently sober. My compliments to Captain Broke, and I shall be happy to wait upon him."
The higher the rank, the later the dinner. Cosnahan was already greasy from his pudding in the midshipman's berth before the gunroom had sat down to their boiled cod, and the cabin's meal was still no more than a remote, though not unpleasing, smell in the galley. Stephen had salivated in vain. He quietly slipped a biscuit from the bread barge into his pocket and returned to Diana. She was more prostrate than ever, now that the Shannon was out in her natural habitat, the full Atlantic swell. A cold, glaucous, apathetic figure, racked from time to time by a spasm, but otherwise mute and apparently insensible. He had already undressed and sponged her, and there was nothing more that his art could do, apart from warm blankets. He tidied her a little, gazed thoughtfully a while, gnawing on his biscuit, and then went below to the cabin that his old shipmate Falconer had vacated for him. He checked his papers, now wrapped in sailcloth, and remembering that he had spoken a little sharply in the night, he did what he could to make himself presentable, to do Jack credit in the cabin. Clean and trimmed at last, he sat on Faulkner's cot, his newly acquired watch in his hand, reflecting on Diana. He had so very much to reflect upon, so very many aspects of a complex relationship, as well as marriage itself, that unknown state, that his thoughts had not run far beyond a long digression on the singular effects, physical and spiritual, of pregnancy, sometimes admirable, sometimes disastrous, before the elegant hands of the watch and a minute chime within told him that it was time to go. His night's sleep, short though it was, had been extraordinarily profound and restorative. His head still ached. He still found it hard to focus his eyes well enough to read, and his cracked ribs hurt abominably on the least false movement. But he was his own master for immediate purposes. He no longer had to struggle with a vacillating, uncertain, exhausted mind, incapable of decision, and although he could not see clearly as far as Diana was concerned, he was able to thrust his grief and sense of bereavement to one side. On the way, he met Cosnahan again, sent to fetch him, for Captain Aubrey placed no reliance on his surgeon's punctuality, but blameless for once, and even commendable, he walked in with quiet triumph. It was a good dinner, oysters, halibut, lobster, turkey poult, and a massive roly-poly that gave the sailors at least a good deal of unaffected pleasure, and since most of the talk ran on nautical affairs, Stephen had plenty of time to consider Captain Broke. He liked what he saw. A slight, dark man, reserved, quiet, grave, and even melancholy, not half Jack's weight, but of much the same size in natural authority and determination. They were obviously close friends, and at first glance this seemed paradoxical, their styles being so very different. The extremes of what was to be found in the service, as different as the centuries, Jack belonging more to the heartier, more flamboyant, hard-drinking 18th. Broke in the more discreet modern age that was spreading so fast even in the conservative navy. Yet they were both sailors, and on this plane they were as one. Their ideas and their aims were both the same. Jack Aubrey was a fighting captain made for the sea and violent action. So, in his different way, was Broke, and perhaps his sense of the Royal Navy's defeat was even stronger, if that were possible. He was a man of strong feelings, and although they rarely appeared, the occasional gleam left Stephen in no doubt. This was particularly apparent when he and Jack talked about the Chesapeake, now the sole object of the Shannon's long blockade, the sole object of Broke's ambition and passionate desire. They had gone over every detail of her equipment before Stephen joined them, and Jack had been able to tell a great deal from the exact nature of her carronades to a very close estimate of her crew, which he set at a little under 400. And now, when they discussed her commander, Jack said,
"Lawrence is a very fine fellow, and I'm sure that if his orders do not compel him to sit still, he will give you a meeting with all the pleasure in the world."
"Oh, how I hope so!" cried Broke with a fine flash. "I have been waiting for him day after day, with our water running low, half allowance this last week, although I took all Tenedos could spare before sending her off, and the idea of being forced off the station, letting him out, or leaving him to Parker, fairly tormented me. I sent in messages by various prisoners I discharged, inviting him to come out, but I dare say they never reached him. I was afraid he might be shy, or that he might share the feelings of so many people in New England."
"Lawrence? Shy? Never in life," said Jack emphatically.
"Well, I am heartily glad of it," said Broke.
and he went on to speak of the feeling in Boston, as far as he had been able to learn it. He had frequently been in touch with the shore, and he had gathered a good deal of information, some of which confirmed what Stephen knew, while some went well beyond it. "The Federalist Party certainly wish any event which would tend to restore peace," he observed, "and that I had from an intelligent person, but just how my man would define any event is a question. It is all very well to subscribe to a general dislike of the war and to give general information on the state of public opinion, but when it comes to specific details that might bring about a defeat, why then I suppose one must reflect that it is one's own country that is concerned, however ill-governed it may be. Now, I know they have a steam vessel, armed with 6 9-pounders, but when it came to information on that head, her power, her speed, her range of action, the possibility of cutting her off with the boats, my man grew shy. When you were on shore, Dr. Maturin, were you able to make any remarks on this steamboat of theirs?" Alas, Dr. Maturin had had no notion of such a vessel. Had she indeed a steam engine mounted in her? What was her means of propulsion? "The engine drives great wheels on either side, sir, like those of a watermill," said Broke. "A precious awkward thing to meet with in a calm or in a narrow tideway, since she can sail not only against wind and tide, but without any wind at all."
"With one long 24-pounder in the bows, such a machine could cut you up quite shockingly," said Jack. "I mean, in light airs or a calm."
The conversation ran on paddle wheels, on the jet propulsion advocated by Benjamin Franklin, on the steamer that Broke had seen on a Scotch canal during the peace, those in service upon the Hudson River, their probable value in war, their short range likely to be improved, the dangers of fire, Admiral Sawyer's fury at the suggestion that one might be used in Halifax Harbour for towing, the probability that sailors should soon have to turn into vile mechanics, in spite of the Admiralty's steady hatred of such a disgraceful innovation, the shortcomings of the Admiralty in general. Captain Broke was a well-bred man, and he often tried to make the conversation general, but with little success. Stephen was usually quiet at meals, given to long fits of abstraction. Now he was quieter still, not only from his ignorance of nautical affairs, but also because sleep kept welling up and threatening to extinguish him entirely. His night, though restorative, had been short. Its effects were wearing off, and he longed for the swinging cot below. Jerking himself from an incipient doze over his pudding, he became aware that Captain Aubrey was about to sing. Jack was the least self-conscious being in the world, and he would sing as naturally as he sneezed.
"I heard it in the Boston madhouse," he said, emptying his glass. "This is how it goes."
He leant back in his chair, and his deep, melodious voice filled the cabin.
"Oh, oh, the mourning dove says, where can she be? She was my only love, but gone from me, oh, gone from me."
"Well sung, Jack," said Broke, and turning to Stephen with his rare smile, "he reminds me of that tuneful lesbian, qui ferox bello tamen inter arma, sive jactatum religarat udo, illitore navim."
"To be sure, sir," said Stephen, "and as far as Bacchus and Venus are concerned, and even at a push, the Muses, what could be more apt? Yet, as I recall, it goes on, et laicum nigris oculis nigroque crine decorum, and although I may well be mistaken, it does not seem to me that the black-haired boy quite suits in a description of Captain Aubrey's tastes."
"Very true, sir, very true," said Broke, put out and disconcerted. "I was forgetting. There are many objectionable passages in the ancients that are best forgotten."
"Ha, ha," said Jack, "I knew it would never answer. Chopping Latin with the doctor. I have known him knock a full admiral on the head before this, with his ablative absolute."
Broke gave a conventional laugh, but it was clear that he was unused to contradiction, that he did not possess his cousin's acute sense of humour, and that he disliked anything remotely approaching to bawdy. He was a graver, more earnest man altogether, and he returned to small arms and great guns with all the earnestness and gravity the moral subject deserved. He described the exercises he had worked out for the frigate, and which the Shannon's people had performed regularly for the last 5 years and more. Monday, seamen at target. Tuesday, swivel men at target. Wednesday, swivels in maintop and all marines at musketry. Thursday, midshipmen at target and carronades.
"Lord, Philip, that must stand you in a pretty penny," said Jack.
thinking of the tons of powder at 8 guineas a barrel billowing away in smoke, 50 cwt for every one of Shannon's broadsides, to say nothing of the shot.
"Yes, last year I sold the meadows over towards the vicarage, where we used to play cricket with the parson's boys, you remember?"
"No luck with prizes?"
"Oh, we have taken a fair number, at least a score this cruise, but I nearly always burn them. I did send in a couple of recaptures the other day, though it cost me a midshipman, a quartermaster, and 2 prime hands, but that was only because they belonged to Halifax. Otherwise I prefer to burn them."
"That's heroic," said Jack, deeply impressed. "But don't it vex your people?"
"In ordinary times it was scarcely answer, but it is different now. After Guerriere I called them aft and told them that if we were to send prizes into Halifax, we should have to man them and thus weaken the ship. We should have less chance of getting our own back if we met one of their heavier frigates. They are reasonable men. They know we are so short of ships on this station, there is little likelihood of recovering our prize hands before we put in ourselves, and they want their own back as much as I do. They agreed. No murmuring, no sullen looks, so very far from it. They know I lose 20 times as much."
Jack nodded. It was a most striking instance of abnegation.
"Well," he said, "and so you exercise your midshipmen separately? That is a very good idea. They cannot learn the men their duty unless they can do it better themselves. A very good idea."
"So it should be, Jack. I had it from you many years ago. You shall see them practicing what you preach this very afternoon. Perhaps, sir," to Stephen, "you would like to see them too, and to view the ship? I have made some changes in the gun sights that might interest a philosophical mind."
Swallowing a yawn, Stephen said that he should be very happy, and presently they walked out, up the ladder, and on to the sunlit quarter-deck. The officers upon it at once moved over to the leeward side, and Broke began the tour with a brass 6-pounder in a port by the Hanses specially made for it.
"This is my own," he said, "and I use it mostly for the youngsters and the ship's boys. They can rattle it in and out without destroying themselves, and they can point it pretty well too by now. And here you have my earlier quarter-sight."
"But what is this?" asked Jack.
"A pendulum," said Broke. "A heavy pendulum. When it is at 0 on this scale, do you see, the deck is horizontal, and at point-blank range a gun will hit its mark even if the captain cannot see it for the smoke. And behind each gun there is a compass cut into the deck, so that it can be trained round on a given bearing if the men are blinded. You know how the smoke lies when there is no great breeze, and what there is stunned by a heavy cannonade?"
Jack nodded, observing that in such cases,
"You could hardly see your neighbour, let alone the enemy."
Then came the carronades, ugly, squat, big-mouthed things, and the stern chasers, long, elegant, and dangerous. A closely reasoned discussion of the best breechings for carronades, the best way to prevent them from oversetting, and so forward along the gangway to the forecastle and its armament, more carronades and the bow chasers.
"Here is my favourite," said Broke, patting the starboard 9-pounder. "With a 2.5-pound charge, she throws as sweet a ball as ever you could wish, true at 1,000 yards. She has my light duty sight, because only the best crew fires her. You shall see the others on the main deck."
"I shall like that," said Jack.
They crossed the forecastle, and he noticed a couple of hands slung below the bowsprit, busy about the figure that to the official mind symbolized not agriculture, nor beer, nor justice, but the River Shannon, carefully painting it with the same sad blue-gray that covered the frigate's sides. There being nobody within earshot, he said,
"Surely to God, Philip, you could afford her a touch of vermilion and a little gold leaf, prizes or no prizes."
"Oh, as to that," said Broke, "we always were a very unostentatious ship, you know, not like poor old Guerriere with all her putty and paintwork. Mind your step, Doctor," he cried, catching Stephen's arm as the frigate's pitch threatened to fling him down the fore hatchway.
The long, low gun deck and the ship's main armament, the massive 18-pounders, bowsed tight up against their ports on either side, their carriages painted the same dull grey, so that they looked like powerful animals bound down, rhinoceroses, perhaps. To and fro along the lines, among the busy parties of seamen, officers, and young gentlemen, Jack bowed from long habit under the beams, Broke upright, full of contained enthusiasm as he spoke of each separate gun. They were all equipped with the captain's simple, ingenious, robust brass sights, and with flintlocks. Jack preferred the old slow match to any lock, and as they argued the point, rooted to the deck, Stephen felt weariness rise to the flood. The pudding lay upon him like a pall. He said something about attending to his patient, and withdrew, hardly noticed in the heat of the discussion. But instead of going directly to the cabin, he walked aft, right aft, along the quarter-deck, to the taffrail, and stood there for a while, staring at the wake and the boats towing astern, their disreputable scow, a launch, and Captain Broke's own gig. He reflected on Captain Broke, an even more devoted, determined man than he had supposed, an austere man and no doubt rather shy in personal relationships. Stephen had the impression that he did not arouse quite the same affection among his crew as did Jack Aubrey, but there was not the least question of their great respect. It appeared to him that Broke lived in a state of unusual tension, as though he had an unusually heavy private cross to bear, and as though great concern with his guns and his ship helped him to do so. It would be interesting to meet Mrs. Broke. The cross was there, whatever its nature, and obviously in a proud man the only sign of it would be the habitual reserve and tacit self-control that he had already remarked in Broke. The Shannon's surgeon joined him, and they talked of seasickness, the vanity of physical treatment on the one hand, and the surprising effect of emotion on the other, at least in some cases. "That man on the larboard gangway there," said the surgeon, "the man in striped pantaloons, chewing tobacco and spitting over the hammock netting, is the master of an American brig we took some days ago. She had just slipped out from Marblehead, and there she was, right under our lee at dawn, and we snapped her up in a trice."
"In a what?"
"A trice. Now, he was as sick as a dog, always was, he told me, the first days at sea, and he had to be helped up the side, puking as he came. Hopeless case, could hardly stand. Did not mind his capture. But the moment he sees his brig on fire, oh, what a change! Colour returns, wrath and passion, a complete cure. Stamps about the deck, swearing, names the cargo, $28,000 worth and uninsured, ruin to his owners. Cured. Never a qualm since. And he has grown philosophical. I wish I could say the same."
"Are not you philosophical, sir?"
"I'm not, sir. I cannot bear to see the prizes burn, with half my share of these last 24. 24, sir, upon my honour. I should have bought myself a snug practice in Tunbridge Wells, and with the whole I should not have needed to practice any more at all. I should have set up for a country gentleman. How I hope that wretched Chesapeake will come out so that we may return to our legalised piracy."
"You have no doubt of the event, then?"
"No more than did the surgeons of Guerriere, Macedonian, Java, and Peacock. But in either case, it will be an end to this torment of seeing my fortune go up in hellish smoke and flames."
"I must attend my patient, sir," said Stephen. "Give you good day."
On the gun deck, Captain Broke was also concerned for Diana Villiers. He said to his first lieutenant, a tall, round-headed man, rather deaf, who bent anxiously to catch his words,
"Mr. Watt, it occurs to me that at quarters this evening we should not make a clean sweep fore and aft. The lady in the master's cabin must not be disturbed. It is only seasickness, and she will no doubt be better tomorrow, but today she must not be disturbed. So let the cabin bulkheads stand. On the other hand, I should like to show Captain Aubrey what we can do, so pray let some targets be prepared."
"Directly, sir," said Watt, and he ran off.
8 bells in the afternoon watch had already struck, and there was little time to spare. The hands who had not overheard the captain's words observed the lieutenant's hurried pace and drew their own conclusions. In any case, the whole ship's company knew what was afoot within 2 minutes, and the gun crews gathered round their pieces, checking trucks and tackles and breechings, shot garlands, swabs and worms, chipping and changing their flints. They knew Captain Aubrey's reputation as a tiger with the great guns, and his former shipmates among them had magnified his deadly accuracy and speed, reducing his factual 3 broadsides in 3 minutes 10 seconds to 3 in 2, and asserting that every shot went home. They did not quite believe it, but they wanted the ship to show well, and they did what little they could. Little it was, because the Shannon's guns were never housed in anything much short of a perfect state, but still a little slush from the galley could ease a block or a truck, and perhaps strike a second off the time. 1 bell in the first dog watch, and Stephen sat down by Diana. A fairly heavy sea was still running, and she was still motionless, a ghastly colour. But she opened her eyes when the drum beat for quarters, and gave him a watery smile. Quarters. And all hands ran to their action stations, and at once the ship took on much of her fighting appearance, her 330 people gathered in tightly ordered groups along her 150 feet of length. The midshipmen, the junior lieutenants, and the marine officers inspected their men, reported to Mr. Watt,
"All present and sober, sir, if you please."
And Mr. Watt, moving 1 step aft and taking off his hat, made the same report to Captain Broke, who who then gave the expected order.
"A clean sweep, fore and aft, on the starboard side. Red cutter away!"
In a few moments all the bulkheads but Diana's had vanished. The cutter splashed down with its load of empty casks, and the boatswain's calls uttered the shrill, cutting pipe that hurried the sail-trimmers from their guns to wear ship, as the Shannon began the long turn that would bring her starboard broadside to bear on the targets to windward. The sun still high in the west, a fine tagansel breeze in the southeast, and the light perfect. But there was rather more sea running than Jack would have liked for accurate practice. She was round, and here was the first target, a cask flying a black flag on a pole, fine on the starboard bow, 300 or 400 yards away. On the gun deck, the familiar orders,
"Silence fore and aft! Out, Tompkins! Run out your guns! Prime!"
All purely formal, since the men moved automatically, having gone through these motions many hundred times, as Jack could see not only from their coordinated ease, but also from the rutted deck behind each piece, scored deep by countless recoils, far too deep for any holy stone.
"3 points, Mr. Itoff," said Broke to the acting master,
and then, taking out his watch,
"Fire as they bear!"
The Shannon's head fell off from the wind, the target came broader on the bow, the bow gun went off, followed a split second later by the rest, in a rippling broadside that came aft in one long roll of enormous thunder. White water sprang up all round the target, the smoke swept inboard and across the deck, the headiest smell in the world. And in the smoke the crews heaved furiously at their tackles, worming, sponging, reloading, and running out their guns.
"My God!"
cried Diana, sitting straight up at the first great crack.
"What's that?"
"They are only exercising the great guns," said Stephen, waving calmly. But his words, if not his gesture, were lost in the prodigious roar of the second broadside, the deep growl of the recoiling guns. The first had knocked away the flag, the second destroyed the cask entirely, but without the slightest pause the crews worked at their guns as the wreckage of the target swept down abaft the beam, whipping the 2-ton cannon smack against the port sills, training them round with handspikes, pointing them, the captains glaring along the sights. Then an unearthly hush as they waited for the top of the roll, the first hint of descent, and a third broadside shattered the remaining staves.
"By God, they will get in a fourth," said Jack aloud.
Already the guns were out again, trained hard aft. The bow gun could not bear, but the remaining 13 sent 200 weight of iron hurtling into the sparse black wreckage of the target, far on the starboard quarter.
"How's your guns?"
said Broke, and turning to Jack,
"4 minutes and 10 seconds.
If you will grant me the bow gun, that is 4 broadsides at 1 minute 2.5 seconds apiece." If it had been any man but Broke, Jack would have told him he lied. But Philip did not lie.
"I congratulate you," he said. "Upon my word I do. A most admirable performance. I have never done so well."
He did admire it heartily, but the less worthy part of Jack Aubrey felt somewhat put out. He had always felt a little superior to Philip, nautically superior, and Philip had equalled or even just beaten his most cherished record. Still, there was the consolation that 2 of the locks had missed fire, which would never have happened with the slow match, and that Philip had had 5 years to train his men, which had never happened to Jack. But it was most capital gunnery, and seeing the pleased, sweating faces looking at him from the waist and the quarter-deck in decent triumph, he added with perfect sincerity,
"Most admirable indeed! I doubt any other ship in the fleet could have done so well."
"Now let us see what the carronades and chasers and small arms can do," said Broke, "if you are sure it will not disturb Mrs. Villiers."
"Oh, no," said Jack, "she is quite used to it. I've seen her handle a fowling piece like any man, and I recall she shot tigers in India. Our father was a soldier in those parts."
Broke hailed the cutter, which laid out more targets, and the carronades, the chasers, and the small-armed men went to work. It was a beautiful sight to see them, the more so as Broke simulated all kinds of emergencies, calling away sail-trimmers, boarders, and firemen from the crews, which nevertheless worked on unperturbed in the apparent confusion, and only a very little slower for the want of hands. A most impressive display, and one that could have been achieved only by the most intelligent and long-continued training, with good liking between officers and men. And it became even more impressive when Broke put his ship about and let fly with the larboard guns. The midshipmen, with their coats off and a look of concentrated eagerness and attention on their faces, fighting their brass 6-pounder. This was immediately above Diana's cot, within hand's reach of her head, and at its high-pitched, ear-splitting explosion she started up again.
"Stephen," she said, "close the window. There's a lamb. I must look utterly disgusting. I am so sorry to be such a spectacle and such a bore. So very, very sorry."
But after the second crash he saw her smile in the half-light, the flash of her teeth. She took his hand and said,
"Lord, Stephen, dear, I'm just beginning to realize it. We have escaped. We have run clean away."
Chapter 9. Jack woke at the changing of the watch to the familiar sound of holy stones and swabs. He was aware that the wind had dropped in the night, but for a moment he could not tell what ship he was in, nor yet what ocean. Then once again the beautiful fact of their escape came flooding into his mind. He smiled in the darkness and said,
"Clear away. We've got clear away."
There was scarcely any light at all below, only just enough for him to make out the shape of Philip Broke moving quietly about the sparsely furnished great cabin where Jack's hammock was slung. And perhaps it was this that threw his sense of place and time out of beat. He had rarely slept in a hammock since he was a master's mate. Broke was already up and dressed. Jack could see the gleam of his gold epaulettes, and presently he tiptoed out to the roar of the great double-handed stones just overhead, and the thump, thump, thump as the afterguard flogged the quarterdeck dry. Jack heard him say good morning to the marine sentry at the cabin door, and then again to the officer of the watch, young Provo Wallace, the Nova Scotian, by the sound of his reply. Smiling still, he sank back into a rosy state between waking and doze. Not only was there a most restful lack of present responsibility, but the tension of yesterday had quite died away. It had persisted well into the night, lasting beyond all reason, but now he could look back upon that series of events as something already in the past. His fury at old Herapath's flight, and Jack had seen him whip the horses, had faded entirely, eclipsed by the contemplation of their luck. Luck all the way. Luck at every turn. He considered old age and its mutilations, and wondered what it would do for him. Examples presented themselves to his mind, not only of mental decay, physical weakness, gout, stone and rheumatism, but of boastful, mendacious garrulity, intense and peevish selfishness, timidity if not cowardice, dirt, concupiscence, avarice. Old Mr. Broke had been tolerably mean. Lord, there was nothing of that in his son. In the course of his career Jack had burnt or released a certain number of prizes in critical situations, so as to keep his crew up to strength, but 24 in a line was something beyond his experience, and he honoured it extremely. True, Philip was comparatively well-to-do, but even richer men loved another 10 or 20,000 guineas. He remembered the nasty wrangle between Nelson, Keith, and St. Vincent over their flag shares in prize money. And even more than Philip's disregard for cash, Jack admired the way he had formed his officers and men so that they followed his opinion and shared his views. Love of prize money was so strong in sea officers and man-of-war's men that it seemed almost contrary to nature. On the other hand, all the Shannons, and not only their captain, had had to swallow the taking of Guerriere, Macedonian, Java, and Peacock, a very bitter string of pills. His mood grew dark at the recollection, and he clenched his fist. Precious little strength there. He felt his arm, bound tight across his chest. Not much pain today, but no power either, scarcely enough to cock a pistol. Broke had formed them very well, and he must have had good material to work upon. He was wrong about his flintlocks, but even so the Shannon's gunnery was excellent. Excellent. There was no other word for it. And Jack was particularly impressed by the small arms men in the tops. The senior marine officer had provided some of his best marksmen with rifled carbines, and they had done remarkable execution, while the swivel guns, firing grape down on a hypothetical deck, had done even better. True murdering pieces, well plied. He had an uneasy feeling that he had never attended to the tops quite as he should have done. Nelson had never much cared for the use of fighting tops in battle, partly because of the danger of fire, and until recently everything that Nelson said was gospel to Jack Aubrey. But on the other hand, he had seen the Java carried into battle in obedience to the great man's dictum, "Never mind manoeuvres, go straight at 'em," and it occurred to him that although Nelson was always right where the French and the Spaniards were concerned, he might have had other views if he had been at war with the Americans. Broke walked in.
"Good morning, Philip," said Jack. "I was just thinking of you and the splendid show of gunnery at quarters."
"I am glad you are pleased," said Broke. "There is no man whose opinion I value more. But the question is, was it up to the Constitution's standard?"
"Why, as to that," said Jack, "I cannot speak exactly for their rate of firing, since I did not have my watch in hand, but I know it was pretty fast. I reckon something short of 2 minutes for their first broadsides, and they did better afterwards. Not as fast as Shannon at any time, perhaps in the ratio of 3 to 4 or even 5, but pretty fast, and most uncommon true. They hit us very, very hard, you know. Yet accuracy for accuracy, I still think you may have the advantage. Your men were firing with an awkward, uneven pitch and roll, whereas Constitution had a much more regular, see, right on the beam most of the time. Upon the whole, I should say Shannon would have outgunned Constitution, though it would have been a near-run thing with their 24-pounders. As for Chesapeake, I know no more than you. I never saw Lawrence do more than run his guns in and out, dumb show. But he did that briskly enough, and he certainly sank poor Peacock off the Demerara River.
Well, said Broke, I hope to put it to the trial today. We are on our last ton of water. I cannot stay, and I mean to send in to tell him so.
Broke's steward coughed discreetly at the door. What a contrast with Killick's way of bursting straight in, his coarse "Whittles is up," and his jerk of the chin, or thumb, or both. And Broke said,
"First breakfast is ready when you are, Jack. I've had mine, and as I know you prefer coffee, I have ordered you a pot. I hope it will be to your liking."
It was not. Philip's steward might be as discreet as a cat, but Jack would have given all his discretion and pretty ways for a pot of Killick's coffee. He'd not had a decent cup since the Java. The Americans had been kind, polite, hospitable, and their sailors thorough seamen, but they had the strangest notion of coffee. A thin, thin brew. A man might drink himself into a dropsy before the stuff raised his spirits even half a degree. Strange people. Their country was coming closer, he observed as he looked through the scuttle. Pouring out another cup of the poor, washy draught, he carried it out onto the quarter-deck. The day was dawning fast, a day full of promise, with a steady breeze in the northwest, and the Shannon was standing in for her morning look at the Chesapeake, perhaps her last look from what Philip had said. All the ritual of washing was over, and the ship presented a beautiful appearance of perfectly scrubbed wood, exactly coiled ropes, yards squared by the lifts and braces, masts and sheets gleaming with fresh slush. It would be an hour at least before the captain of the afterguard called for sweepers. Not a spit-and-polish ship, worn indeed and shabby, particularly in her sails, but clean and eminently serviceable. There was no brass that he could see, apart from the resplendent bell forward, the lambent quarter-deck 6-pounder, and the sights all along. The busy deck full of hands were doing something more directly connected with war than making metal shine. Some chipped corroded round-shot, others made foxes, paunches, and seizings, and the forward pumps wheezed round, discharging a thin stream over the side. The hen-coops were already up. The proud cock crowed, clapping his wings in the first rays of the sun, and a hen cried out that she had laid an egg, an egg, an egg! Philip himself was talking to an American shipmaster, one of his prisoners, and over beyond him a score of men, a large party, stood dubiously round the carronades, while some of their number slowly pushed them in and out, under the guidance of 2 grizzled quarter-gunners with pigtails down to their waists. The Shannons knew that their captain did not like the name of the Lord to be taken in vain, and that he detested coarse expressions. The captain was present, well within earshot, and the course of instruction had a somewhat unearthly air, with its supernatural patience and mild persuasion.
"Good morning, Mr. Watt," said Jack to the first lieutenant. "Is there any sign of Dr. Maturin yet?" "Good morning, sir," said Watt, leaning his good ear towards him. "I'm entirely to your way of thinking." "I am glad of that," said Jack, and in a rather louder voice, "Have you seen anything of Dr. Maturin this morning?"
"No, sir, but there is Coco waiting for him in the gunroom."
"That will set him up, I am sure. Pray, what are those men by the carronades? They scarcely look like Shannons."
"They are Irish labourers, sir. We took them out of a Halifax privateer that had taken them from an American privateer that had taken them from a Waterford brig. The poor souls hardly knew where they were. But when we told them it was the Shannon and gave them some grog, they seemed pleased, and screeched out in their heathen way. The captain let these fellows enter, though we find it very hard to teach them their duty, seeing that only three of them speak any English. But I hope they will be useful if it comes to boarding. They have terrible battles among themselves. You see those three with broken heads, and they understand the use of pikes and axes. Oh, Dr. Maturin, sir, good morning to you. I trust you found your cocoa hot?
I did, sir, and return all due thanks, said Stephen, looking wistfully at Jack's cup.
And neither he nor Aubrey could love the morning until they had drunk a pint or so of true, freshly roasted and freshly ground boiling coffee. The cock crowed again, and several of the Irishmen cried,
"Mac na haig aslan!"
"What do they say?"
asked Jack, turning to Stephen.
"Hail to the Virgin Sun," said Stephen. "We say that in Ireland when we hear the first cock crow of the day, so that if we meet a sudden death before the day is out, we may also meet with grace."
"They must keep that until we rig church," said Watt. "We cannot have Christian practices on weekdays, nor Christian precautions."
"How is Mrs. Villiers?" asked Jack.
"Somewhat better, I thank you," said Stephen. "Will I look at your cup, now? It has the curious pattern on its side."
"Infamous hogwash," murmured Jack, as the first lieutenant moved away to leeward on his captain's approach.
"Listen, Jack," said Stephen in the same low voice. "Diana says that sea captains can marry people. Is it true?"
Jack nodded, but no more, for Broke was at hand, politely asking for news of Mrs. Villiers. Stephen said that the most distressing symptoms were over, that a tonic draught, such as coffee of triple or even quadruple strength, followed by a small bowl of arrowroot gruel, reasonably slab, would set her up by the afternoon.
"And then, sir," he added, "you would oblige me infinitely by marrying us, if you have the leisure."
Captain Broke paused for a moment. Was this a strangely timed pleasantry? Judging from the doctor's demeanour and his pale, determined face, it was not.
Should he wish him joy of the occasion?
Perhaps, in view of Jack's silence and Matchin's cool, matter-of-fact, unfestive manner, that might be inappropriate. He remembered his own wedding day, and the desperate feeling of being caught on a lee shore in a gale of wind, unable to claw off, tide setting hard against him, anchors coming home. He said,
"I should be very happy, sir, but I have never performed the manoeuvre, that is, the ceremony, and I'm not sure of the forms nor of the extent of my powers. You will allow me to consult the printed instructions, and let you know how far I may be of service to you and the lady?"
Stephen bowed and walked off. Broke said,
"Cousin Jack, a word with you."
And in the privacy of the after cabin he went on,
"Is your friend serious? He looked grave enough, in all conscience. But surely he is a Romanist, is he not? He must know that even if I can perform this marriage, it is meaningless to those of his persuasion. Why not wait until we are in Halifax, where a priest can do his business for him?"
"Oh, he is perfectly serious," said Jack. "He has wanted to marry her ever since the peace. She is Sophie's first cousin, you know."
"But why the hurry? Don't he know we shall be in port before the week is out?"
"That is the very point, I take it," said Jack. "I gather there is some question about her nationality. She might possibly be considered an enemy alien, and a marriage on board would settle the matter out of hand."
"I see, I see. You have never married anyone aboard ship, Jack, I suppose?"
"Not I, but I'm fairly sure it can be done. The captain of a king's ship can do close on anything for a man except hang him without a court-martial."
"Well, I shall look into the instructions. But first I should like you to read this letter. It is addressed to Captain Lawrence. I have sent in several messages by word of mouth, saying I should like to meet him ship to ship, but from what you say about him, I imagine they were either not delivered, or that his orders kept him in port. Now it seems to me that the people ashore must know you are gone off by this, with Shannon as your obvious refuge. And since they were so eager to keep you, they might be equally eager to get you back again, and therefore more willing to send Chesapeake to sea. In any case, a written challenge has so very much more weight than anything verbal at second hand. So, with these two considerations in mind, I mean to send my letter in by an American prisoner, a respectable man called Slocum, who lives in these parts. His boat is alongside, and he has undertaken to deliver it. But you know Lawrence. You know what kind of letter is likely to have an effect? Please read it, and tell me what you think. I have tried to put it in a plain, straightforward manner, no rhetoric, no flourishes, the kind of challenge I should like myself. But I do not know if I have succeeded, and I hope you will tell me, without the least disguise."
Jack took the letter. "His Britannic Majesty's ship Shannon, off Boston, June 1813.
Sir,
As the Chesapeake appears now ready for sea, I request you will do me the favour to meet the Shannon with her ship to ship, to try the fortune of our respective flags. To an officer of your character, it requires some apology for proceeding to further particulars. Be assured, sir, that it is not from any doubt I can entertain of your wishing to close with my proposals, but merely to provide an answer to any objection which might be made, and very reasonably, upon the chance of our receiving unfair support. After the diligent attention we had paid to Commodore Rogers, the pains I took to detach all force but the Shannon and Tenedos to such a distance that they could not possibly join in any action fought in sight of the Capes, and various verbal messages which had been sent into Boston to that effect, we were much disappointed to find the Commodore had eluded us by sailing the first chance, after the prevailing easterly winds had obliged us to keep an offing from the coast. He perhaps wished for some stronger assurance of a fair meeting. I am, therefore, induced to address you more particularly, and to assure you that what I write I pledge my honour to perform to the utmost of my power. The Shannon mounts 24 guns upon her broadside, and one light boat gun, 18-pounders on her main deck, and 32-pound carronades on her quarter-deck and forecastle, and is manned with a complement of 300 men and boys, a large proportion of the latter, besides 30 seamen, boys, and passengers, who were taken out of recaptured vessels lately. I am thus minute, because a report has prevailed in some of the Boston papers that we had 150 men additional sent us from La Hogue, which really never was the case. La Hogue is now at Halifax for provisions, and I will send all other ships beyond the power of interfering with us, and meet you wherever it is most agreeable to you within the limits of the undermentioned rendezvous, viz. From 6 to 10 leagues east of Cape Cod Lighthouse, from 8 to 10 leagues east of Cape Ann Light on Cash's Ledge in latitude 43 north, or at any bearing and distance you please to fix off the South Breakers of Nantucket or the Shoal in St. George's Bank. If you will favour me with any plan of signals or telegraph, I will warn you, if sailing under this promise, should any of my friends be too nigh, or anywhere in sight, until I can detach them out of my way. Or I would sail with you under a flag of truce to any place you think safest from our cruisers, hauling it down when fair to begin hostilities. You must, sir, be aware that my proposals are highly advantageous to you, as you cannot proceed to sea singly in the Chesapeake without imminent risk of being crushed by the superior force of the numerous British squadrons which are now abroad, where all your efforts, in case of a rencontre, would, however gallant, be perfectly hopeless. I entreat you, sir, not to imagine that I am urged by mere personal vanity to the wish of meeting the Chesapeake, or that I depend only upon your personal ambition for your acceding to this invitation. We both have nobler motives. You will feel it as a compliment if I say that the result of our meeting may be the most grateful service I can render to my country, and I doubt not that you, equally confident of success, will feel convinced that it is only by repeated triumphs in even combat that your little navy can now hope to console your country for the loss of that trade it cannot protect. Favour me with a speedy reply. We are short of provisions and water, and cannot stay long here. I have the honour to be, sir, your obedient humble servant, P.B.V. Broke, captain of H.B.M.'s ship, Shannon. Jack skipped the postscript, apart from the last words, "Choose your terms, but let us meet," and handed back the letter.
"No," he said, "I think that is perfectly in order for a man like Lawrence. For my part, I should have left out the fling about even combats and little navy. He knows all that as well as you or I, but I think it will certainly bring him out, unless he is under absolute orders to stay in port."
"Very well," said Broke, "then I shall send it." He stepped to the door, but then, recollecting himself, he called, "Pass the word for my clerk." A small aged man in dusty black clothes and an ill-fitting tie wig came in, and said in a harsh, shrill old voice,
"Is it to be rewrote?"
"No, Mr. Dunn," said Broke. "Captain Aubrey is so good as to approve it as it stands."
"I am glad of that," said the clerk, with no evident sign of pleasure. "I have wrote it 3 times already, correcting the expressions, and there is a mort of work at a stand. Complete book, quarterly account, and slop book, all to be finished and wrote fair before we reach Halifax. Well, sir, what now?"
He had no teeth, and as he fixed his testy, red-rimmed eyes on his captain, so he munched his gums, bringing his nose and chin close together in a way that had daunted post-captains before Broke was born.
"Well, Mr. Dunn," said Broke in a tone that lacked its usual authority, "I should like you to look through the printed instructions, or any other papers that may occur to one of your great experience,
for information on marriage at sea in the absence of a chaplain, the powers of the captain, and the due forms to be observed. The clerk sniffed, took out his spectacles, wiped them, and peered at Jack, then, seeming to change his mind about some tart reply, walked out, muttering,
"Marriage! Marriage! God preserve us all!"
"I inherited him from Butler when they gave me Druid," said Broke, "and have suffered under him ever since. It is much the same with my bosun. He served under Rodney, and we were shipmates in Majestic when I was a squeaker. He taught me how to make a midshipman's hitch, and he used to cuff me when I got it wrong. He was quite bald even then. They lead me a sad dance of it between them, and if it were not that they know their duties through and through... However, we must get this letter off." The captain, Broke, who emerged onto the quarterdeck with a letter in his hand, did not look as though any man on earth could tyrannize over him, nor as though any subordinate could lead him a dance, however old, slim, self-contained, and, as it were, invulnerable. He glanced eagerly at the land, automatically at the sky and the set of his sails, and turned to the American. "Here is the letter, Captain Slocum, if you will be so good," he said. "All is ready, I believe, Mr. Watt?"
Yes, sir. The gentleman's boat is alongside, with his men and his dunnage already in it."
Leaning over the rail, he added in a powerful voice,
"Mind the paintwork there!"
"Good morning to you, then, Captain," said Slocum in a harsh nasal drawl, putting the letter away and preparing to leave. "I reckon we may meet again, maybe a little later today, and I dare say my owners will be overjoyed to see you."
His face, with its sardonic expression and unwinking hostile gaze, vanished below the rail. The boat shoved off, hoisted its sail, and sped away close-hauled on the brisk northwesterly breeze over the bright blue sea. They watched it grow smaller in the distance, the sail shining in the brilliant day. Fine on the larboard bow lay Cape Cod, on the starboard quarter Cape Ann, and on the beam, right down at the bottom of the enormous bay, Boston and Chesapeake. The master, or rather the acting master, a young man named Etoff, was the officer of the watch. To him the captain gave orders that brought the Shannon round in the track of the boat, following it in slowly under topsails alone. Then he said, "Mr. Watt, will you care to breakfast with me?" And looking about among the young gentlemen on the quarterdeck, he chose a lean midshipman and added, "Mr. Littlejohn, do you choose to join us?"
"Oh, yes, sir, if you please," said Mr. Littlejohn, who had smelt the captain's bacon this last 5 minutes, and whose soul was ravished away by the thought of the eggs that might accompany it. The midshipman's berth had been on short allowance this many a day.
The breakfast was indeed magnificent. The steward, aware of Captain Aubrey's appetite and willing to do his ship honour, had broken out almost all his remaining stores. The third part of a Brunswick ham, kippered herrings, pickled salmon, 17 mutton chops coming hot and hot, besides eggs, a kind of toasted scone, and 2 pots of orange marmalade, small beer, tea and coffee as the doctor had recommended it to be made. There was little conversation, however. Broke was silent and withdrawn, and by long-established naval tradition his first lieutenant could not speak without being spoken to. Yet this did not apply to Jack, and he addressed a few remarks to Mr. Watt, but he was on the wrong side of the lieutenant's good ear, and after 1 or 2 attempts he confined himself to Littlejohn.
"Are you any kin to the Captain Littlejohn of the Berwick?" he asked.
"Yes, sir," said the youth, quickly swallowing. "He was my father."
"Ah," said Jack, wishing he had asked some other question. "We were shipmates once, long ago, in Utep. A thorough seaman. I do not suppose," he said, considering Littlejohn's age, his lack of emotion, and the year the French took the Berwick, "I do not suppose you remember him very clearly."
"No, sir, not at all."
"Could you eat another chop?"
"Oh, yes, sir, if you please."
Jack thought of his own boy, still in coats. Some day would George reply to the same question in the same words, with the same decent but unmoved gravity, and continue eating with the same undiminished appetite?
"I'm sorry to cut breakfast short, gentlemen," said Broke, after a just decent interval, "but I hope we shall have a great deal to do today."
He stood up, and they followed him out. A certain odd, nervous tension was evident on the crowded quarterdeck, too, and indeed throughout the frigate men moved quietly, rarely speaking, often glancing far over the bay where Slocum's boat had vanished, or at their captain.
"Mr. Etoff," said Broke, "colours and best pennant, if you please, and lay her for Boston Lighthouse."
The Shannon's ordinary pennant came down on deck for the first time for months, a frayed, wind-worn and now rather stubby object, although it was the mark of a king's ship in commission. The replacement soared up to the main royal truck, and there broke out one of the Shannon's rare luxuries, a long, long sapphire-coloured silk affair that streamed over her quarter high above, while at the same time a worn blue ensign appeared at her mizzen-peak, and an equally shabby union at the jackstaff. The breeze had slackened, backing a little westward, and the frigate, as close to the wind as she would lie, scarcely made good 2 knots against the ebbing tide.
"Masthead there!" called Broke. "What do you make of the boat?"
The lookout's voice came down.
"That ain't in yet, sir! No, not by a long chalk!"
Almost imperceptibly the shore came closer, more distinct. The arms of the bay thrust very slowly further out to sea, so that Cape Ann crept towards the Shannon's beam, bearing north by west, then past each several shroud to north by west a half north, and due north itself. In the dim light of the curtained master's cabin, Stephen said very softly, "How are you feeling now, Villiers?" No reply. No pause in the even breathing. She had gone to sleep at last. And with the quietness of the ship, the smoothness of the motion in this untroubled water, her whole person had relaxed. Her fists were no longer clenched. Her face had lost the fierce, obstinate look of resistance. And although it was still pale, it was no longer deathly. Her gruel had done her good. She had washed in what little water the Shannon could afford her, and above all, she had done her hair. It streamed up, pure black, on the pillow, showing the boyish fluting of her neck, and an ear whose formal perfection surpassed that of any shell he had ever seen. He contemplated her for a while, and then slipped out. As he stood on the main deck, blinking against the brilliance of the day, bemused, deep in his own thoughts, impeding the busy men, the captain of the maintop, a former patient of 3 ships ago, took him gently by the elbow and saying, "This way, sir, clap on with both hands now," guided him up the ladder to the quarter-deck. Here he joined the purser, the surgeon, and the clerk who welcomed him, told him that they were lying to off the lighthouse, that there on the port bow were the Graves, and then the Roaring Bulls, and that today they had great hopes of— Their words ceased abruptly as Captain Broke desired Mr. Wallace, the second lieutenant, to carry a glass up to the masthead and tell him what he saw. Young Wallace sprang onto the hammock cloths and ran up the ratlins as though up an easy flight of stairs, up and up. And from the jacks his voice floated down into the listening silence.
"On deck there! Sir, Chesapeake is out in the road, at single anchor, I believe. She has had royal yards crossed.
Where is the boat?"
"Sir?"
"Where is Slocum's boat?"
"Still this side of the Green Island, sir,"
called Wallace after a searching pause, and the silence fell again, broken by the sounding of 7 bells in the forenoon watch.
"If she is in the outer road, and if she has crossed her royal yards, she is most certainly coming out. She will win her anchor at slack water and sail on the first of the ebb,"
said Mr. Dunn, munching his gums with satisfaction. He had the printed instructions under his arm, and a sheaf of papers folded into the book, but his whole being was directed landwards, to the burial, rather than to the marriage service.
"To what do you refer?" asked Stephen.
"By the Chesapeake, of course," they cried,
and the purser added, "Constitution won't be ready for sea this month and more." They fell to a close discussion of the state of the tide, the steadiness of the wind, and the new double-breaching of the carronades. Although Stephen's acquaintance with these theoretically non-combatant gentlemen had been short, he had already observed that they were even more martial than the rest. Dunn the clerk and Aldham the purser had commanded parties of small-arms men at quarters, blazing away themselves like fury, each with 2 loaders, and the surgeon had bitterly lamented that his post below the waterline always kept him from any action except the occasional boat expedition. But even so, Stephen was surprised by their steady flow of technicalities, their keen appreciation of the finer points, their heartfelt longing for violence and bloodshed. Their flow was cut off short by another hail from the masthead.
"Sir, they are shipping the capstan bars!"
A pause.
"She drops her for topsail! Main and mizzen!" Some trouble with her anchor.
A foul anchor won't take Lawrence long, muttered Jack.
He is coming out, said Broke, turning to his officers with a smile. Mr. Etoff, we will dispense with a noon observation. Strike 8 bells and let the hands go to dinner at once.
All hands were prepared for this. The aged boatswain already had his call to his lips as the marine hurried past him to strike the bell, a sound almost invariably followed by the enormous hullabaloo of cooks bawling out mess numbers, men running and roaring with mess kids, sailors beating on their plates and banging tables. But on this occasion, strangely muted. It was as strange as the calmness with which the Shannons received their captain's statement to his first lieutenant, made loud and clear that today grog would be cut by half, to be made up some other time. Having made this announcement, Broke hailed the masthead again for news of the boat. It was still well short of the Chesapeake.
"It is not my challenge that is bringing him out, then," he said to Jack, "but rather a desire for your company."
After a few moments, he said, "I'm going aloft. I wish you could come with me, but I do not suppose you can use your arm."
"For the masthead, no," said Jack. "But I can't manage the main top, through the lubber's hole."
They crossed the deck, and Dunn moved forward to intercept them.
"For this marriage, sir," he said, "I am afraid it is within your competence, and it seems that banns are not required at sea. Here are all the references, and I have marked the Book of Common Prayer."
"I really cannot attend to a marriage now, Mr. Dunn," said Broke. "I'm going aloft. But now I come to think of it, the lady must be moved. We are likely to clear for action very soon, and she must be moved. Mr. Watt, tell me the state of the forepeak."
"Well, sir, now that the pigs are all gone, it is pretty salubrious, apart from the rats and cockroaches. Then as soon as the men have finished their dinner, let it be prepared. It may be sprinkled with eau de cologne. There is an unopened bottle in my quarter gallery, and a cot may be slung." Then, raising his voice,
"Mr. Wallace, come down and wait for us in the top."
"Easy does it, Jack," he said, as his cousin began to climb like an ungainly three-armed spider.
Between them, Broke and Wallace heaved his 16-stone into the sighting-top, and Broke carried on to the masthead, running aloft like a boy. Wallace passed Jack his telescope, arranged for a stunsail for him to sit on, and observed that,
"It must be devilish awkward, with only one arm."
"Oh, as for that," said Jack, "I'm perfectly all right on deck. After all, Nelson boarded the San Nicolas and then the San Joseph with only one eye, and won the Nile with only one arm.
Will you leave me your glass, Mr. Wallace?"
"Thank you."
The young man vanished. Jack glanced about the top, a spacious, convenient top, with a stouter armour of red-covered hammocks wedged into the netting between the stanchions than he had seen in a frigate, and 2 1-pound swivel guns aside, and then settled to focusing the telescope, a difficult task with the fingers of his right hand only just peeping from the bandage and the sling. The blur grew clearer. A cautious twist, and there was the Chesapeake, sharp and clear among a crowd of small craft. Jack could not see her forecastle, an island was in the way, but at the masthead Broke had a perfect view, and he called down,
"Anchor's apeak! They pawl and back!"
At this moment the American frigate fired a gun, dropped her t'gansels, and sheeted them home.
"Anchor's away!" called Broke. "He plucked it up in fine style!"
Now the Chesapeake cleared the island, full into Jack's sight, and he could see the hands laying aloft to rig out the stunsail booms. The breeze was as fair as it could be, and as soon as Lawrence was clear of the last turn in the channel, clear of the light, he would set them on either side. Already the yachts and small craft had spread all the sail they possessed, the breeze being lighter in with the shore. On the Shannon's deck the hour of grog had arrived. The fife was squeaking Nancy Dawson, the master's mate, stood by the tub, ladling the half-rations, but this high point of the seaman's day lacked all its wonted fire. The hands tossed off their half-pints, barely savouring the rum, and hurried on to the forecastle and the starboard gangway and into the foremast rigging to stare at the Chesapeake. The whole watch below was high aloft. Broke remained at his masthead for a while, saying nothing, watching with passionate intensity. Jack, having already seen the Chesapeake at much closer quarters, swept the harbour with his glass and the town. He saw the Asclepia and picked out his very window, the broad, straight street running up to the State House, the street with a hotel in it. And he searched among the distant shipping for the Arcturus before returning to the frigate and her attendant crowd of boats. And now here was Broke, running down the topmast shrouds.
"Well, Philip," said he, smiling, "your prayers are answered.
Yes, said Broke, but was it right to pray for such a thing?
He spoke very gravely, yet his face was lit up, almost transfigured.
Come, let me give you a hand past the futtocks.
On deck again, and Broke said to the officer of the watch, Course due east, Mr. Faulkner, and we may keep under an easy sail. The backed topsail filled. The Shannon turned smoothly, brought the wind right aft, and stood out to sea. She had hardly gathered way before the Chesapeake rounded the lighthouse and set stunsails aloft and alow, and they sheeted home together, while at the same moment her royals flashed out over all. A pretty piece of seamanship. From the Shannon's deck she was hull down, and indeed the lower part of her courses could not be seen except upon the rise. She was about 10 miles away, and even with royals and stunsails abroad she would not be able to make much more than 6 or 7 knots with this breeze, even with the ebbing tide. There was plenty of time to draw her right out into the offing, beyond the capes, where there was all the sea-room in the world. Plenty of time. And since the Shannon made a clean sweep fore and aft almost every day at quarters, since the cabin furniture was so sparse and so contrived that it could be struck down into the hold in a very few minutes, while the officers' bulkheads and canvas screens vanished even sooner, and since she always had enough ammunition on deck for 3 broadsides, it seemed that there might be little to do to fill those necessary hours. Yet in even the most zealous ship there was a world of difference between clearing for action with a purely ideal enemy and preparing for battle with a large, formidable frigate that could actually be seen, that had the weather gauge, and that showed every sign of a determination to close as soon as possible. Apart from anything else, no officers made their wills or wrote what might be their last letters home before quarters, whereas many, including both Jack and his cousin, now determined to do so as soon as they had the leisure. And then there was all the boatswain's work, puddening and chaining the yards, and the gunners, filling more cartridge, rousing up more shot, grape, round, and canister, to say nothing of the wetting and sanding of the decks, the rigging of splinter netting overhead, the spreading of damp fear-naught screens over the ways to the magazine, the placing of scuttle-butts of water for the men to drink between bouts. But as far as the surgeons were concerned, all instruments were to be thoroughly overhauled, and in many cases sharpened. And before the galley fires were put out, there was also the minor question of the officers' dinner. Jack was already longing for his, but when Broke proposed a last tour of the guns, he walked along with him and the gunner and the first lieutenant, without more than a private murmur. As he had expected, not even the keenest eye could find anything amiss, but he was glad when, on reaching the forecastle, Broke asked him whether he had any suggestions to make.
"Since you ask me," he said, "I should like to see slow match as well as flint locks. Your locks can miss fire, scatter the priming. A match whipped across can save the shot, and I believe you cannot afford to waste a single shot with a gentleman over the way."
Nodding towards the distant, but not so very distant, Chesapeake, now under t'gallant stunsails as well.
"Besides, it is the old way, and I like old ways as well as new."
The gunner coughed approvingly, and Mr. Watt, who had caught the remark, said,
"Aye, indeed. The fathers that begot us."
Broke considered, and then said,
"Yes, thank you, cousin. We must certainly not waste a single shot. Mr. Watt, let it be so. But, Lord, I am forgetting. How does the forepeak come along?"
"It is as trim and trim as we could make it, sir. It is not an abode of angels, like the master's cabin, but at least it smells as sweet as new-mown hay."
"I must wait upon the lady," said Captain Broke, glancing at the Chesapeake and then at the sun. "Pass the word for Dr. Maturin. Dr. Maturin, how good of you to come. Is Mrs. Villiers well enough to receive me, do you think? I should like to pay my respects, and explain that she has to be removed into the forepeak, as we may very shortly be in action."
"She is considerably better today, sir," said Stephen, "and would, I am sure, be glad of a short visit."
"Very well. Then pray be so kind as to let her know that in 15 minutes' time I shall do myself the honour of waiting on her."
The guns were finished. The officers were gone to their dinner in the gunroom. Broke tapped on the cabin door.
"Good afternoon, ma'am," he said. "My name is Broke, in command of this ship, and I am come to ask you how you do, and to say that I fear we must ask you to change your quarters. There may be a certain amount of noise presently, indeed an action, but I beg you will not be alarmed. You will be in no danger in the forepeak, and the noise will be much less. I regret it will be dark and somewhat cramped, but I trust you will not have to stay there long."
"Oh," said she, with great conviction, "I am not at all frightened, sir, I assure you. I am only so sorry to be a burden, a useless burden."
If you will be so kind as to give me your arm, I shall go along at once and be out of the way.
She had had time to change, to prepare herself, and when she stood up in her travelling habit, she looked more than usually elegant. Broke led her forward through lines of transfixed seamen, all of whom, after one quick, astonished glance, stared straight out through the open gun ports. Forward, then down and down to the forepeak, well under the waterline.